It likely won't shock you when I tell you that police don't like to talk about their investigations. In fact, you can ask any reporter, and I used to be one, for the phrase they hear most from the cops, and the answer will always be, we can't comment on an ongoing investigation. But investigations end, and trials happen, and verdicts are rendered, and then documents are made public. Lots of documents. And so, if you have the right documents, and you ask the right questions of the right cops, you can get inside the most complicated of cases. Like the task force that caught Bruce MacArthur, who pleaded guilty in February to killing 8 men over 7 years in one of Canada's most horrific cases of serial murder. Toronto police faced a lot of criticism over how they handled that case, both for how long it took them to investigate the men going missing in the gay village, and for famously insisting, just a month before MacArthur was caught, that
the fact that there was a serial killer that was out there, the evidence does not point to that, the evidence does not suggest that.
You can judge for yourself whether the cops were doing their best on a complicated case or gaslighting a community that had little reason to trust them. Our job here is not to prove or deny that criticism, but to give you an inside look at what police knew and when and how those critical pieces were put together. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Wendy Gillis is the crime reporter at the Toronto Star. She got those documents and asked those cops the right questions and put together a comprehensive look at what went on while police were chasing a serial killer. Can you start by explaining what we're learning now about the MacArthur investigation that we kind of didn't know when we covered the crimes or when we covered the guilty plea?
Yeah, absolutely. What we're learning through some of these documents that came out a couple of weeks ago are some of the finer details of this investigation. For me, this story all started, obviously, with MacArthur's arrest, but the sort of endeavor to try and get some of the details of this investigation started with an application that myself and my colleague Kenyon Wallace put in March of 2018, a couple of months after MacArthur's arrest.
Right.
To try and get court documents that would show us some of the steps that police took along the way to arrest MacArthur, but also years earlier, what they'd done to investigate the disappearances of missing men from Toronto's gay village. Those documents are called ITOs.
Okay.
Stands for information to obtain. And essentially, it's the case that they put to the court for why they should be allowed to do certain kind of invasive investigative steps.
Such as?
Such as tracking someone. So putting a tracker on their vehicle to get live updates on where they're going.
Right.
Getting access to their cell phone. That could be data. That could be sort of trying to understand who they're communicating with. And one of the most invasive ones that they did end up doing in this case was to get permission to go covertly search Bruce MacArthur's apartment. And that was obtained through a general warrant.
We've talked about Bruce MacArthur a couple of times on this podcast, and it's always in the context of, rightly so, the victims in the community or how long it took to get to his arrest. And that's been a sticking point with a lot of people who have covered this case or even just watched it unfold.
Yeah, and seeing the work that was done is really instructive to that end. We got upwards of, I think it was 36 ITOs from Project Houston, which, as you know, was the investigation into the first 3 missing men from Toronto's gay village, Skanda Navaratnam, Abdul Bazir Faizi, and Majid Kahan. And they went missing in between 2010 and 2012. And there was roughly an 18-month task force that was formed to investigate their disappearance. And I think one of the most interesting aspects of the most recent release of these documents from the courts was getting a detailed view of what they did during that investigation. We knew that they had identified someone who they thought might be responsible for the death of Skanda Navaratnam, and that was a man out in Peterborough who police believed was involved in a cannibalism ring. And it's really interesting to see the resources that went into investigating that individual.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that does show that these disappearances were taken seriously at the time and they were investigated. Unfortunately, they identified the wrong person. What I think is very important to note from some of the Project Houston warrants is that, and to be fair, police have also been pretty upfront about this as well, is that the identification of three brown middle-aged men having gone missing from the village, that wasn't something that was generated by Toronto Police itself. That came out of a tip that came from across the world, a man who thought that he had identified a cannibal in Toronto. And that was how they began to stop and say, oh, I guess we have a few men who fall into this category of brown men from the village who've gone missing. And I think that is a really important issue. And hopefully it's actually already been solved, because in the last year, Toronto Police have created a special missing persons unit that would hopefully now be able to identify the kinds of patterns that come up when you have the same sorts of people going missing.
So you looked at a ton of court documents and ITOs and interviewed some of the detectives who worked on the case. As you kind of sat down to put all that together and find out how to craft a narrative, what are the first things that stood out in your mind?
Mm-hmm. I have to say I'm really lucky that I was given the time and the space to do that kind of reporting and writing, and I'm really thankful for that. And it was not a solo effort.
Yeah.
I had help from my colleague, and I had incredible editing from my editor, Ed Tupp. What stood out for me always, sort of, and what's interesting is that we got a look at these documents way back in the fall, but because there was an ongoing trial, MacArthur had not yet pled guilty, there are his fair trial rights. So all of these documents are sort of redacted. And then after he pled guilty, we got one ITO that was sort of representative that was far less redacted. So we got more information there. So I guess my point is it was sort of a gradual release of information. And throughout that process, it always was astonishing to me the ways in which this investigation could have gone off the rails. Like, there were all kinds of times when there was excellent police work or there were major hurdles that came up and everything could have gone wrong. So a couple examples is Bruce MacArthur's van went missing, and it was missing for about 2 weeks. And that was because MacArthur had purchased a new van and he had driven it out to a relative's home, and police had followed it there. And they knew that it was potentially very crucial to the investigation. And in fact, it was incredibly important to their investigation. What ended up happening was they saw it parked at the relative's home. Then it stopped being there. They would go back and check on it, and it was gone. And that's a scary thing. And it was gone for about 2 weeks. And finally, they decided, okay, we have to go find this thing. And they started checking sort of auto wreckers. And he just happened to drop it off at a place where they salvage parts. And so the van was pretty much intact. They would end up finding evidence in that van that was absolutely critical to that investigation, and that was a very small blood spatter from Andrew Kinsman. And what that did was enable the investigators to take Bruce MacArthur from a person of interest in Andrew Kinsman's death to a suspect in his murder.
Well, let's tell the story of that investigation then from the point of view of the investigators. Maybe start with when Bruce MacArthur became a person of interest.
Mm-hmm.
When did he first show up on their radar, and what happened internally?
And what's interesting, too, is that Bruce MacArthur was investigated during Project Houston as well.
Right.
So that's important to know.
And I think we've kind of, people know that because, again, that was one of the things that always comes up as a failing of the police work, because that is what it looks like. You know, they had him, he was right there, and nothing happened until he resurfaced as part of Project Prism.
Prism, yes.
So how did that come about?
So Project Prism was formed in August of 2017, and it came about after Andrew Kinsman's disappearance in June of 2017. That disappearance came only a few months after a man named Salim Essen went missing. He was also a well-known person within the village. So there was a lot of public outcry and concern expressed, and Toronto Police struck a task force. Because I think it's important to understand that when someone goes missing, it is investigated. But I mean, I'm not a police officer, but my understanding is that it can be difficult to focus on a single case when you're at the detachment. They're really, really busy, especially 51 Division where this was happening. And so they struck a task force that would clear up several officers, give them just sort of one thing to do. and that was investigate Andrew Kinsman's disappearance and Celine Messin's disappearance. At that time, they had no evidence, as far as I know, that they were connected at all, but it made sense for this team to kind of tackle it together. A few days into Project Prism, investigators were reviewing some of the surveillance footage that had been captured soon after Andrew Kinsman's death, and they were able to determine around the time that Andrew had gone missing. I know that they had been talking to neighbors and trying to figure out, you know, who had the last contact. And as I understand it, they knew that he had gone missing sometime in the afternoon. They were reviewing the footage and realized that sort of in the top right corner, I mean, I don't know which one they looked at first, but Ultimately they were able to determine that there was a red van that came to a stop near Andrew Kinsman's apartment, sort of very close across the street. And there was a figure who appeared to be Andrew Kinsman who got into that van. And they did not know what that van was. They could not see the face of the individual who was driving, and they could not see the license plate. And so to me, that's what is really quite impressive, is that they were able to take that red van and determine that it was a Dodge. So they took it to a Dodge dealership. And I spoke to Mario Wong, who was the salesman who spoke to the police. He was just very forthright with me. He was like, yeah, of course I told them. You know, he felt it was really important to do his part to help this investigation, even though the officers who came to speak to him didn't tell him what they were doing.
Yeah.
But he knew based on some of the sort of the appearance package, as they call it, that this was a 2004 20th anniversary Dodge Caravan. What the investigators do is they request all of the ownership information for those vans, for that make and model. So they get the spreadsheet, and Detective David Dickinson, who was the sort of primary investigator on Project Prism, he told me that he was at his home. He opened up the spreadsheet at like 10 p.m. at his dining room table and searched for Bruce, because Bruce had been written on Andrew Kinsman's calendar on June 26th, which was the day that he went missing. And they had no idea what the importance of Bruce was, but they were able to determine it to be something that they had to sort of test or discount. And that's how an investigation like this has been explained to me, is that they sort of test everything until it is proven to be irrelevant. And So he searches Bruce in that spreadsheet, and five owners have that name. Only one of them owned that specific make of the van, and also only one of them had any recent contact with police. And so that was Bruce MacArthur. And that recent contact was in 2016, when a man alleged that MacArthur had strangled him inside MacArthur's own van and that he'd gotten away. I mean, you can imagine that discovery. This is a man who is likely gay, who has been accused of assaulting someone in his van. And that's the same van that's seen picking up Andrew Kinsman at the same time that he appears to disappear. So I know that was quite an important moment in that investigation, and it really just builds from there.
What does that put in motion from the perspective of the investigators when they have that?
That puts in motion someone who is a person of interest. He was made a person of interest within a few days of that investigation. It's really remarkable to see how quickly things progressed from there. I mean, the day after that discovery is made from the spreadsheet, there's an investigator who's at the Thorncliffe Park apartment where MacArthur lived. So they're there and they're learning everything that they can about where he's coming and going. There's like a key fob, so that can kind of record your comings and goings. And also It recorded when it was being used to open the parkade, right? So they could tell when he was driving. They do get ultimately get permission from the courts to put a tracker on his vehicles. So they've discovered that he's since purchased a new van, and that he has taken his old van to his relatives, and that's how it's discovered that the van is missing.
And that's when he goes, when they find the van and they find blood in it, then he becomes a suspect.
Yeah. So that happens fairly quickly. That's over the course of a couple of months. The discovery of Andrew Kinsman's blood came in early November. And what's interesting to think about is that, you know, a natural question might be, well, why didn't they just arrest Bruce MacArthur then, when they
that
knew
was possibly
that,
my next question.
So I guess the amount that they found in the van wasn't a lot. I think the largest was about the size of a penny. And so it's not enough to have a really strong case against Bruce MacArthur. So what they did was they really amped up the surveillance of him, not only to try to understand his patterns and find out where he's going. That's what the initial surveillance had been about. But now they're really concerned about public safety. So they're trying to mitigate risk that is posed by someone who could very well be a murderer.
So all the surveillance is currently on MacArthur, and now that he's a suspect, police have additional powers. When does that turn into the holy shit, we got him moment?
So they went into his apartment, as I was talking about. They did a covert search in early December 2017. November, as I understand it, was really, really warm. And so that would have skewed some of his landscaping patterns, because they'd been watching him kind of moving, going from house to house and job to job. And in early December, all of a sudden it got cold, and that completely changed his patterns. And so that's exactly when they get permission to go into his apartment. And so they go in, and they're in the process of searching inside his apartment, but also downloading some of his digital sort of files, like his computer. Then they realize that he's actually on his way back. And normally he would be out of the house for a while, but his patterns have shifted and he's on his way back, and they have to leave the apartment earlier than they thought. So they'd only downloaded about 45% of his, I believe it was his external hard drive and his computer. There were a few sort of digital things that they downloaded. And so they were only working with less than half of what they might have if MacArthur hadn't been coming back to his apartment. And that started a more than month-long process of sifting through all of that. Now, I don't know exactly what that entails. There's all kinds of software, and that's, police are pretty secretive about that for obvious reasons. But they're looking at, you know, whether he's pulled up maps, you know, what the content of his searches, like that kind of thing. They've also done quite an extensive image search too. But on January 17th, it was one of the Project Prism team members, his name is Joel Manhurst, who had 30 minutes to spare before he had to go testify in court. And that was really interesting to me. He just used a little bit of extra time he had, and in that time found absolutely crucial evidence. So he used sort of a photo-specific software to run a search, and what came up was what we now know are post-mortem images of men. I can't imagine what it'd be like to find those, but from an investigative standpoint, it's really important. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to say that this was a good thing. This is obviously an awful thing, but it was critical evidence that they needed. And as that day went on, more images arose. And this is not just evidence that Bruce MacArthur has killed one person. This is evidence that, you know, very strong evidence that he has killed multiple people. As we now know, there were men who weren't even on police radar at that point. They didn't know that they'd been missing.
Yeah.
So those 2 days, you know, when they found those pictures, they decide that they're going to arrest Bruce MacArthur. They know at that point that they would charge him in the deaths of Andrew Kinsman and Salim Essen.
And this is all coming a week or two after there was that infamous press conference where they said,
about a month after.
That they said, yeah, we have no evidence that there's a serial killer operating.
Yes, yes.
And before we get to the conclusion of this, and I'm not going to ask you to weigh in one way or another, but explain from the investigator's point of view how they make a statement like that at a press conference, because it did come back to bite them.
Right. From Chief Mark Saunders' point of view, what he said was accurate. And how I understand the investigation, it was accurate. They had Andrew Kinsman and Bruce MacArthur linked. Bruce MacArthur was a suspect in one person's homicide. The criticism has centered on they had identified Bruce MacArthur as someone who might be involved in some way in the deaths of the other men. And we now know that because there was conjecture that was contained in some of those warrants, those ITOs that are filed. So when the police are going to the courts to ask for these powers, they're saying, you know, we think that Bruce MacArthur might be involved in Andrew Kinsman's disappearance. That's how it was initially. And then he becomes a suspect in the murder. And also, there are these men who disappeared from the village, and their disappearances have never been solved, and this causes us concern. So it's being, contextually, they're being put together.
Right.
I think what has upset many people in the community, from what I'm hearing from my sources, is that there was some kind of element of gaslighting that was going on. Because there had been, you know, this years-long concern that men had been going missing and people were saying the word serial killer.
Yeah.
That to have the chief of police say that there wasn't the evidence to back that up, and then only a few weeks later, sure enough, that's what they had on their hands, that has been destabilizing, I think, to many people. You can see, though, how quickly it evolved from having Bruce MacArthur be a suspect in Andrew Kinsman's killing to suddenly being a serial killer. We know that that actually happened in the course of a day.
Tell me about the rest of that day then. Once they find the photos, mm-hmm. what happens?
So the decision is made to arrest Bruce MacArthur. But to preserve the integrity of a major case like this, they have to do everything possible to make sure that evidence is not lost. It's important to remember that at this time, they didn't know if Bruce MacArthur was acting alone. So there were people that they thought might be helping him. They had no evidence, I should stress it, no evidence of that, but they didn't have evidence to the contrary either.
Right.
So they had to make sure that police were in place and that warrants were in the process, you know, before the courts, to be able to search certain addresses. That included the Mallory Crescent address, where we now sadly know that Bruce had kept some of his victims' bodies, all of his victims' bodies. So they knew that they needed some time to get that in place, 2 or 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
So the decision is made, we're going to arrest him. I believe it was on a Saturday, and I think this was a Wednesday. And, you know, give or take, there's a few days in there. And so they decided we're going to watch him, you know, round the clock and get everything in place. But there's a caveat, and that caveat is from the images that they've found, they know that it's very likely that Bruce MacArthur killed one person or more in his bedroom or in his apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And prior to that, the theory had been that Andrew Kinsman had been killed in his van. And so police have ways to intervene, and they have far more control when the scene of a crime, per se, is a vehicle. They don't have that control when it's an apartment, when it's someone's own residence.
Mm-hmm.
So the rule, the caveat was, under no circumstances can Bruce MacArthur be alone in his home with another man.
Right.
And sure enough, what does he do? Less than 24 hours later, he takes a man back to his apartment alone.
And then what happens?
Well, everything, the way that I understand it was sort of controlled chaos. The decision is made to arrest MacArthur immediately. There are already some officers at MacArthur's apartment building. Dave Dickinson, the primary investigator, goes to the scene very quickly, and they go up to his apartment and they arrest him. And what's really quite tragic and remarkable is that the individual who he had in his apartment, the court documents had identified him by a pseudonym, John.
Mm-hmm.
And John had been handcuffed and was naked, and a black bag had been put over his head. And that's, you know, when police went into the apartment, they found him handcuffed. And Justice McMahon, who was the judge on this case, said in basically no uncertain terms that he was sure that John was going to be the next victim. So it was really good that they intervened.
What did some of the police officers that you talked to in the course of this investigation tell you it was like to work on something like that was stale for so long and then finished so quickly and furiously?
What I know is that they are really pleased that they could bring some finality to the families who had been wondering for so long. You know, and that point can't be overstated. These people didn't know what happened to their loved ones. That's different from having your relative be the victim of a violent crime.
Mm-hmm.
And so to have, number one, the uncertainty of what happened, And then number two, finally finding out what happened and having it be so horrific. Those are two different kinds of grief, as I understand it. And so at least to bring an end to the suffering of not knowing, I think that has been really big for the police that I have heard from. I think it's important to know that there is an ongoing review right now being done by former Ontario Court of Appeal Justice Gloria Epstein.
How do the police feel about that? Did they talk to you about that at all?
This was officially endorsed by the Toronto Police. Chief Saunders has supported this. And it's the Toronto Police Services Board who unanimously passed, basically. They asked for this altogether. Okay. To be perfectly honest with you, I think that they actually support it because it's going to come out with some recommendations about how to do things better. And everyone can get behind that, I think.
Thanks, Wendy.
You're welcome.
Wendy Gillis is a crime reporter at the Toronto Star. And that was The Big Story. You know where we are by now. It's thebigstorypodcast.ca or at TheBigStoryFPN on Twitter or at Frequency Pods on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. And frequencypodcastnetwork.com is your place for all our shows. We'd love to hear what you think. Get a rating, get a review, or just have you subscribe. We're on every podcast platform you can imagine, from Apple to Google to Stitcher to Spotify to iCatcher. I don't know if they made that a pun on purpose or not, but it's a good one. Claire Broussard is the lead producer of The Big Story. Ryan Clark and Stephanie Phillips are our associate producers. Annalisa Nielsen is our digital editor. Lucas Iannetta is our research assistant. And I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the long weekend. We'll talk Tuesday.